shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt, on Sputnik International. My special guest today is the broadcaster, the radio presenter, the columnist, and indeed the host of Johnny Gould Jewish State podcast, Mr. Johnny Gould himself.
Shooting from the Lip.
Good afternoon, Johnny.
Always a pleasure, John. How are you?
I'm fabulous, considering I'm locked down until about 2023. But we'll come on to that in a minute. I really want to talk to you first, if we can, about Israel, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Was there a meeting last week between Saudi and Israel?
John, there was a meeting, and Netanyahu met the Crown Prince, and he also brought the head of Mossad with him as well. This meeting was long scheduled. It's been long in development, and that had Trump won the second term in the presidential election, then Saudi Arabia would have joined the Abraham Accords, which now contains the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. Trump hasn't won, which means that it is expedient for Israel and the Saudi Arabians, however far away they are from actually signing a deal, to warn the Biden presidency that life in the Middle East goes on in spite of Biden and Obama and the various crews of the Democrats being on the other side. And that is no exaggeration. They are on the side of Iran.
So how much credit can Trump take for making this happen? And how devastating is it in that one aspect for peace in the Middle East, the fact that he hasn't won? And I think we have to accept he hasn't won now.
Yes, Trump hasn't won, and Biden will be the next president of the United States. I think we can safely say that. Trump can take every single plaudit for this. He is entirely responsible for bringing a new peace, a new normalization between unlikely nations in the Middle East. Trump, you know, he may not be a great master or a great intellect or even a sort of a great strategist in terms of it, but he had the right people around him. The first year, I would make an exception. I think Steve Bannon was bad for Trump. But after him, he surrounded himself with people like the ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, a chap called Jason Greenblatt, who was his chief negotiator in the Middle East, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who, you know, despite being like in daddy's business or in daddy-in-law's business, is actually a very capable individual. And the Trump administration started maturing and basically, in my opinion, and I think on many others, including your audience, started to back the right team. And the UAE and Israel, you know, culturally are different, but in terms of infrastructure and ambition, and in terms of digitalization and all sorts of other 21st century concepts are quite similar. Their economics are similar. Their GDPs are similar. UAE's is slightly bigger than Israel's, but they're moving ahead. Bahrain feel the same thing. And if Saudi come on board, that really will be an absolutely enormous and new groundbreaking peace between two very powerful nations in the Middle East.
Well, let's hope so. Talk to me then about how did Trump lose? And were you surprised that he lost?
I'm shocked. And I do feel, I'm not going to add to conspiracy here, but how did the losing president achieve the biggest set of votes of all time except for the winner? I read last night that Biden will have secured 80 million votes. And that, you know, in many states, the important states, Trump was in the lead until they started counting the ballots. We know in this country how balloting, the postal ones, are open to, what should we say, changing things. I don't really contribute to that because it might be that he lost and, you know, so be it. But let's just say the establishment, and Biden represents the establishment, have had 4 years to sort out this shock in a free or fair election that Trump won. And the same goes for Brexit in this country. We have seen over and over how, you know, the establishment has tried to stop Brexit from happening, despite the will of the people going with Farage and Boris Johnson and who else was involved in this, Dominic Cummings. So it is a fight back, I believe, from the establishment. Everyone is against Trump in the media. Everyone who contributes to Trump's, I don't know, rudeness or Rudy Giuliani's guy falling down the sides of his face is dripping against what might be a legitimate standing.
As a side issue, we'll come back to Biden in a moment, but just look at the UK. I mean, you mentioned postal voting. Would you cut postal voting back down in this country? I think when it started in 2001, didn't it, under Blair, it's just got massive now. I think the only people who should get a postal vote are the armed services or if you're severely disabled. I don't like postal voting. What about you?
Yeah, people use it as a convenience rather than an actual necessity. I agree. It should be for the old and infirm. It should be for military. It should be for people who are stationed a long way away on duty in other ways. For people, I don't know, nurses and doctors, for example, who can't get out during election day if they're doing an emergency operation or something. You know, democracy needs to stand and you need to turn up. There's not enough security around our elections. And, you know, in the old days, we really trusted these institutions, didn't we, John? And yeah. We don't trust them as well now. And trust needs to be put back into the system. And, you know, for us to declare these opinions makes us sound like cranks. How can it? How can we be described as that when actually all we want is a tradition of fair play and electioneering to actually amount to something? I think we have it still in this country. I believe we do. And I agree with you, John, that postal voting needs to have some new regulation.
Okay. So let's go back to Biden. What kind of president do you think he'll make? And also, what does it mean for us in the UK? And do you think the world will be a safer place? I mean, we've got to remember, of course, Donald Trump didn't take America or the world into any wars whilst he was president.
That's absolutely right. He believed in peace. There was an example where he was advised that he should go into Iran and bomb an important strategic site. And he was told by his generals that it would kill 150 people. So he called it off. They went after Soleimani instead, you know, that big general, the Revolutionary Guard's top dog, which knocked Iran's block off. And we haven't really heard much from Iran since then because they know they couldn't take this president on. So what's occurred there is that they've emboldened and set off their proxies, Hezbollah in the north at Lebanon and Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the south in Gaza. So Iran fights its wars parallel to America instead.
Do you give any credit to the story that he was thinking of bombing Iran before he handed over the presidency to drop Biden in it? Or was that just some kind of nonsense?
Yeah, I don't believe it. I think we're going to see some very interesting presidential pardons go on. I think we're going to see some negotiations between him and the new presidency, because I think he is worried as a private citizen what might happen to him. We're talking about America here. It sounds like a banana republic, doesn't it?
It does.
And, you know, one thing America needs to do is to start representing itself again. And I'm sorry, I don't think that's the Democrats. I think that it's like Obama's been elected again. We've seen a lot of him in the media, haven't we?
We have.
I mean, it's a shame. And I just hope that post-Trump world, they don't go after supporting Iran again, because that will make, you know, peace on the streets in Europe look more vulnerable again. It's scary times, because Trump was an adjunct to that. And I make no apology for saying that.
What do you think then about the situation with Iran? I mean, do you think that would be more than just saber rattling? Will they be emboldened by Biden? Will they get this terrible deal, as Trump used to describe it, the Iran-American deal? Is that going to be resurrected, do you think?
I fear it is. I know already that the Palestinian Authority have opened up negotiations with some of the Biden administration in waiting, because they knew that Trump wasn't going to have a bar of them. They'd said no all the time, including to his peace to prosperity plan, the deal of the century. And so that was the end of that. Trump, just to remind everyone, had offered the Palestinians $50 billion in aid as long as they came to the table within a four-year time span to discuss peace in the Middle East and peace and recognition with Israel. In between that, the UAE and Bahrain negotiated peace with Israel. And John Kerry, who is now unfortunately part of the Biden administration again, is the absolute buffoon, absolute idiot, who very publicly said, make no mistake, there will be no Middle East peace without the Palestinians. I mean, what an idiot. His career should be over. And of course, now he's in an administration which, in my opinion, is dysfunctional on day one.
Okay, let's go now back to the States itself. I mean, I was particularly disturbed during the election with the kind of polarisation which could be characterised by blacks versus whites.
Yeah.
Are you concerned that's going to be stirred up, or, I mean, they barricaded the whole of DC because they thought there might be riots. But clearly that was riots if Trump had won, not the other way around. So where do you think that's going to go? Where's race relations now in the United States of America? And Biden's election, does that polarize it even more?
Yes, it does, because they cannot stop talking about race on the left. All they want to do is talk about identity politics. If you look at Kamala Harris's Twitter feed, it says my prefixes are she and her. Beg your pardon, not he. She and her.
That'd be good.
And yes. I wish they would stop talking about it, because they talk about the Latino vote. Okay, that's so annoying, because if you actually chip that down, the Cubans voted Trump to a very large degree in Florida, and the Puerto Ricans voted for Biden. Because the Cubans understand the ravages of communism, and that's why they live in America. They're grateful to be Americans and to be away from that poverty-stricken country. And, you know, this idea, Douglas Murray talks about it in his book, that he's the wrong kind of gay man because he's not with the, you know, he's not with the brothers and sisters of the gay community, because he doesn't believe or accept it. And the same goes for African-Americans. You know, there were plenty of African-Americans who want to get on in their life, and they voted Trump.
Well, Florida proved that, didn't it? And that's why I couldn't believe that he didn't win. When Florida, I mean, they held it back. But on the night, I think about 5:30, I went to bed just for half an hour, came back down, and I thought he'd done it. My wife was sort of stirring. She said, "What's happened?" I said, "Trump's back in." Had half an hour's kip, got back up, and he'd lost.
Yeah.
Because he had won in Florida, which no one expected. And he'd got Hispanic votes. He'd got black African males voting for him, and women. I just don't get it. And again, I'm not into the conspiracies, but it's bonkers.
It's bonkers. People asked in 2016 why so many women had voted for Donald Trump when he talked about grabbing ladies' private parts and all sorts of other things that he'd been caught on tape accidentally saying, and sounding like an idiot. You know, I'm not defending him at all.
No, of course not.
It sounded like an idiot. But the answer to that question is that not every female is a woman, in the sense that they're also mums, and they're also, you know, heads of the family, and they're aunties. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to say, that this idea of women being some kind of political kind of movement is an extra definition to just the simple definition of being a woman. So that is simply why females voted for Donald Trump, because they see themselves not necessarily as archetypal feminists.
Okay, I think that's a brilliant point. Now, just before we go to the break, let's talk about Biden. Is he going to survive the hot? Well, is he still going to be ready for the inauguration? Is he going to survive the full 4 years, or do you see a President Harris before the next election?
He's old, isn't he?
Yep.
He's extremely polished. He's easily the most experienced politician to ever ascend to the presidency. So he will look presidential in a way that the left seem to obsess about, in a way that for me is completely unnecessary. He uses all the right words. He wears the right suit. He has been around the block. Whether he has the health and fitness, we may not see him on a daily basis. We may see Harris sort of take the podium. And of course, on the days where she does, everyone's going to ask, is Sleepy Joe all right? This is the question. So he has to be quite visible. What is fascinating is that if he doesn't make it or steps down and Kamala Harris wins the nomination to be the next Democratic president, she'll either be up against Donald Trump, who fancies his chances again in 2024. Maybe his ship has sailed now.
Well, he'll be 78 himself by then as well, of course.
Well, he'll still be younger than Sleepy Joe, won't he? Which is interesting.
That's true. Yeah.
But the other person on the Republican side, who, if you know, it could be an all-female. This is obviously huge speculation, but I can't think of anyone better in the Republican Party to represent them in the next presidential election than Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN. So for the first time ever, it is possible that we might see an all-female presidency.
Okay, let's hold that there. Hold that thought, because now I want to go in the second half of the show to talk about our supreme leader here in the UK, Mr. Boris Johnson, who's self-isolating but still issuing diktats from his bedroom, is it? Or his bunker? More coming up in the second half of Shooting from the Lip on Sputnik International with me, John Gaunt, and my very special guest, Johnny Gould, from the Jewish State podcast. Don't dare go away.
Shooting from the Lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt. Shooting from the Lip.
OK, Johnny, we're back for the second half of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt, and, as I say, Johnny Gould. Johnny, let's talk about the man I've sarcastically called our supreme leader. Doesn't inspire confidence that he's in his bedroom or his flat, he's talking to the commons and the internet connection goes down. It looks like he's on dial-up. Why haven't they put a proper broadcast facility in there? And secondly, it doesn't inspire confidence. The man got COVID himself. He was at death's door and now he's had breakfast with a load of backbench MPs and he's self-isolating again. What's going on? Who's in charge of the ship?
When he was Mayor of London, he used to get the plaudits for his supreme delegation. He was able to rely on a crack team of people that let him concentrate on him writing his memoirs or doing whatever he likes to do at weekends.
I think we know what that is, but go on.
And I think he is a delegator. I think he relied way too much on Dominic Cummings. When I spoke to Nick Timothy, who of course was the Dominic Cummings of the Theresa May administration, although albeit quite a different animal to Dominic Cummings, let's make no mistake about it. He was chief of staff. He said that in his administration, and indeed that of Tony Blair's, you could rely on a number of big brains. So that if Alistair Campbell got knocked back by Tony Blair, there was always Jonathan Powell, there was Peter Mandelson, there were other big fish that could help him think and strategize. And I think Boris was very, very one-handed with Dominic Cummings. And now that he's gone, we are going to see a very different complexion to the premiership. But as we speak, John, to answer your question directly, there is, as you say, a bit of a vacuum. He's in isolation. Cummings has gone. I think Carrie Symons is the acting prime minister. And, you know, we've got... and, of course, now we have the spending review, which is... not just for this year, but will give us a clue of how we dig ourselves out of COVID-19 going into 2021, 22 and 23 with either printing money, writing debts off or increasing tax, which I think they're softening us up for.
OK, let's go on to that in a moment. Let's just talk first of all about him being in isolation. Nigel Farage, of course, threatening to bring his Brexit party back as the Reform Party. He's tweeting like a madman today saying that Boris Johnson doesn't need to be isolated. I've got to agree with Farage. He's had it. As he said himself, he's as fit as a butcher's dog. Like a dog's dinner to me the other day when he was on the telly. But he's also full of antibodies. There's no need for him to do it. Why is he doing it? It's all pathetic. And now we get a situation where businessmen, if they've been on a business trip, they only have to isolate for 5 days. Or if you've got a few pounds, you can pay for your isolation to be cut. The whole thing... there's no science behind it, is there?
No, it's all... they've given up on it being scientific, and it's now about consensus and what they can get away with and what they think the people will accept, or at least Piers Morgan shouting in the morning for 3 hours at us. Because I think he is effectively the leader of the opposition, isn't he?
Well, it's Keir Starmer, isn't it? That's for sure. Go on.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he scares the bejesus out of everyone, doesn't he, every morning, saying, if you don't wear a mask, you are a killer. You're responsible. That's the sort of message we're getting. And, you know, anecdotal evidence of, you know, a kid breathing on his grandma and she's dead. Oh, dear. You know, whereas I quite like Peter Hitchens' extreme. And this is the other extreme. I'm not sure. I think we've got to find somewhere in the middle here.
I agree.
Peter Hitchens said, well, if they didn't keep on going on about it in the media, most of us would struggle to realise this thing was even happening. Which is funny, but obviously a little bit extreme on the other side.
And he goes on and on about face muzzles, doesn't he? So let me take you through this then. Have you been wearing a mask?
I have. And in the last episode that we talked about, John, when I was on the show, I said I wear it, you know, to respect other people in the street.
Yeah, I remember.
And I veer away from people if that's what they want. And indeed, you know, I don't doubt it exists. But I'm going to apply common sense, which is I don't want anyone accidentally spittooning into my mouth when they're talking. Equally, I don't want them sneezing or breathing near me, so I keep my distance. And I'm hoping that also when I come home and I've touched the handle on a bus or something, that I make sure that my hands are fully washed. And that's the extent of my concern with this.
What about the vaccination, Johnny? Are you going to be wanting the vaccination?
I'm not going to be first in the queue. John, I must say, I want to see what it does. You know, when you rush out these things, you know, we are of a generation that remember children growing into adults with thalidomide.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to say that this is a terrible vaccine. It might be very good. It might be like the flu vaccine for all we know.
Well, that's only 60% effective. That said, I had mine the other week. For the last 4 or 5 years, I haven't had it. I felt a bit rough once when I had it. So I just stopped having it and didn't get flu. But this year, maybe I've been scared into it. Thank you, Piers. And I had the flu jab and I would have the COVID jab, but let Boris go first. How about that? We are in lockdown 3, aren't we? Or we will be on December the 3rd. You mentioned earlier they're softening us up for tax rises. I felt they were also softening us up for saying everybody's in tier 3 or at least tier 2 and 2 and 3.
Yeah, I tend to agree with what you're saying here. Let's not forget that this lockdown happened as Sheffield, Liverpool and Manchester all jockeyed for approximately £29 per head of their population to go around for their more severe lockdown. And they were asking the question, well, why isn't London involved in a lockdown as well? So I think what they did was to bring to an end this sort of breakup of the population, another north-south divide jealousy sort of question, is to sort of lock down the whole lot of us because it suited them politically and expediently. And yes, I totally agree with you. This is not to do with science. This is to do with politics. And today we are going to be softened up for tax rises. People honestly think that we should have tax rises when perhaps the opposite challenge would be that the government should write off a lot of the debts and actually encourage business to come back within a framework that everyone understands and that is equal, because all the debate now is about, well, you know, where's my bit? You know, he's got his bit, where's my bit? And it's all about taking. It's not about earning. It's not about working. It's about unions starting to say, oh, we need a 4-day week.
Well, they want a pay rise.
They want a pay rise in a 4-day week. Sounds like Alf Garnett. Like Alf Garnett.
At least Boris didn't shoot himself in the foot again, and he stood up and said MPs aren't going to get this £3,500 pay rise. There'd have been riots on the street if he had. But what do you think about pubs? Do you think pubs should be open now?
I think the hospitality industry has taken great steps to build screens and to build pods for everyone and put shields up, and let them do that to a certain extent. And you know, if they do want a security guy on the front to say, look, sorry, guys, there's 50 people in here. There'd normally be 150. I'm sorry, I can't let you in. I think most people would understand that. The problem is, of course, this curfew and everyone gets on the bus home at the same time. You know, but I'm sure people who are focusing on management of people more than you and I do can come up with ideas to encourage people out and about again, because this isn't a solution.
So do you think Boris has lost the country at this point? Or is he on a precipice here?
I think that at the moment, with an 80-seat majority, he hasn't got to worry too much about the country because, of course, he doesn't need to fight another election until 2024. What he has to worry about is his backbenchers and his 1922 committees.
Yeah.
And they are ruthless. I mean, look at the way they finally dealt with Theresa May. I mean, they pledged their loyalty and then they didn't. And they will do the same to Boris if he doesn't get his act together. The fact of the matter is, though, that Boris has produced this huge majority and he has a little bit more swing time than he has normally. But there are people within the Conservative administration that have performed quite well in this lockdown. I'm thinking of people like Rishi Sunak, who, you know, has given out money like it's going out of fashion. Grant Shapps looks like a pretty safe pair of hands. But the only problem with Rishi Sunak is there's a major design flaw. And that is that he looks like a hard left chancellor, doesn't he, by giving all the money away. Mm. And the people who voted in the, you know, the Sedgefields and the Red Cars and the Workingtons, you know, that went Tory for the first time in two generations, will be saying, well, if he does the same as a Labour Party prime minister, well, I may as well vote Labour next time. So I think for now, Boris is safe. But I think actually his enemies are probably closer to his door than us, the electorate.
So do you believe that we're going to be out of this by Easter? I made the point the other day. People said, oh, that's April. And I said, oh, no, I'm showing my local radio heritage. Easter's late this year. It's April the 24th. Well, that's May, isn't it? What do you reckon?
I think it's entirely reliant on what France, Italy, Japan, the United States and Sweden do, because this has been by consensus how everyone else is handling it. If you're an outlier country like Sweden, woe betide you get it wrong. You know, everyone's saying how wonderful New Zealand is. I think partly they are not as globalized as other countries and they're a very, very long way away. They're a bit lucky in this COVID war. Unfortunately, John, it's not just down to us in isolation. Unfortunately, we will be lifting restrictions alongside other mature Western nations.
Do you think, to use the Alan Partridge line, we can bounce back, or are you worried about the future? I mean, you're a self-employed type of guy like me. I mean, many of us have had no help off the government, but do you think the economy will come back? Rishi's promising loads of money to retrain people, but is there going to be the appetite to employ them?
I am very optimistic about the future, John, because there's so much opportunity out there. And there's a will and an optimism to keep going. I am trying to hold it together in my freelance, self-employed kind of way, John. I am getting on with the projects that I need to get on with as best as I can. And sure, I'm compromised. And yes, I'm worried about demand falling off for what I have to sell. And indeed, for the people that I deal with who rely on demand that has nothing to do with me. Yes, we are, of course, heading for a recession, but there is an optimism and there is a will for people to go out and continue going on holiday in July next year. There is a will and a desire to keep paying the rent because they need somewhere to live, or to keep paying the mortgage, or to keep trading, and indeed to go and see Howard Jones or Nick Kershaw or any of the other 80s celebrities who are desperate to get back into business because they have no other way of living their lives age 65. Now, they all want to go and see their superstars in tours. You know, if you listen to Radio 2, they're absolutely demented. All these stars saying, oh, I'm so looking forward to getting back on tour in May. You know, so there's this will to go out and eat spaghetti and go and see Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
I think that's a brilliant way to end the programme. Thank you very much indeed. That's Johnny Gould. Johnny Gould, we're from the Jewish State podcast. What did you make of that? I'll be back next Friday with another guest who I'm sure will be just as forthright, but I'm not sure they'll be as funny as Johnny. Thanks for listening. This is John Gaunt. This is Sputnik International. And that was Shooting from the Lip.
Shooting from the Lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.